With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. On September 5th, 1982, Johnny Gosch spoke to a man in a blue car before he began his Sunday paper route. Moments later, he would be gone, with his red wagon full of undelivered newspapers left behind. A lackluster police investigation led to his case going cold rather quickly, but the next several years would be filled with sightings and other signs that Johnny was out there somewhere. all culminating with a jailhouse confession from a man who claimed he knew exactly what happened to Johnny Gosch because he's the one who helped kidnap him. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Johnny Gosch. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. If you are on our Patreon, you probably just heard us, but for everyone else, it is next week. We are living in the future, everybody. This is also our season two finale. So I want to take a moment to thank everyone who has listened to us in our first two seasons.
Yeah, I can't believe we've been doing this for 2 years.
We have not. Not how the seasons work.
2 seasons. Fine.
We've been doing this for like, I don't know, not even a year and a half. But I went back and checked before recording this, and our first season had 16 regular episodes, while this season had 36. And that doesn't include any of the bonus episodes or anything like that.
You're working me to death.
Oh my God. It's been a lot. So thank you to everyone who has listened, recommended us, joined our Patreon, or left a review. It is absolutely amazing to us.
Thank you so much.
But I need a little bit of a break. My hope is that I will finally discover the discipline to write these more ahead of time and not be scrambling every single week.
I don't see that happening.
I know, but like, I just want to believe. But these episodes take a lot of time to research and write, and I have houses I need to sell. Speaking of which, if you're browsing Zillow or Redfin while you're listening to this, let's chat. I may be based in Northern Virginia, but I can help people anywhere. And I've actually spoken with a few of our listeners about their home searches, which is very cool. So I would love to help any of you. You can just reach out on our podcast, social media, because I run it all anyway, or you can email me at my work at kona@c21redwood.com. My website is callkona.com, and I have a contact form there as well.
Wait, are you one of our sponsors now?
Yes, I am.
is your LLC giving us money?
Listen, no, or yes, I don't know, whatever makes it more kosher for tax purposes, I'm actually not sure. But, you know, it's our season finale, so I wanted to throw it in there because people keep on telling me to do that. But anyway, let's get to our last episode of season two and talk more about Johnny Gosch's story. We left off last week with a teaser about a confession. And so I'll say right off the bat, like, this is not someone who called into a tip line and confessed, because I'm sure they also got a ton of those.
Sure.
This actually originally came from a lawyer, which I didn't realize until I was reading it. Because again, before I started really digging into this case and writing it, I watched the documentary Who Took Johnny? And so I got like the basic overview of everything from that. And then, you know, kind of did the research, read the newspaper articles, things like that. So the way this happened was in 1990, an Omaha, Nebraska lawyer named John DeCamp came forward and said that during an interview with a psychiatrist, his client, a man named Paul Benassi, mentioned an incident with an Iowa paperboy. DeCamp was reading the transcripts of this interview, and it struck him as odd because, like, Paul went into a few more details, and it kind of like, it's one of those things that kind of just niggled at him because he's like, this sounds like something, you know, but it was pre-internet. And so He couldn't just like pull out his phone and look up like Iowa paperboy, you know? So he actually went to the library to do some research. And after he did that, he came to believe that Paul was talking about
Johnny Gosch's abduction. And Paul had even given the date of Johnny's abduction in this interview with the psychiatrist. He went to Benassi about this and eventually contacted the Gosches with a bombshell. His client had confessed to helping abduct their son.
Okay, but like, are we going to get further into the confession here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Then we will get into the details of it.
Pause my questions.
Yeah. Okay. Now, interestingly, when DeCamp called the Gosches, he reached John Gosch, and he didn't initially tell Noreen about this. He went on his own to the prison to talk to Benassi and came away believing him. But he wasn't really 100%, right? Like, yes, he believed his story, but he didn't like believe him. Because again, at this point, there had been so many hoaxes and everything that they couldn't believe anyone really. So he hired yet another private investigator, a man named Roy Stevens. And so Roy's job was to follow up with Benassi and see if his story actually held water. Roy went to the jail where Benassi was being held on child molestation charges and interviewed him on several different occasions. Roy Stevens says that he talked to Benassi for hundreds of hours. During these interviews, a story emerged. Basically, according to Benassi, a man named Emilio brought him to Des Moines to help abduct Johnny Gosch. Emilio was apparently the man who did the actual abducting for a pedophile ring. Now, Paul Bonacci himself had been taken by Emilio and brought into this ring and abused.
Wait, brought into the ring as a child?
Yeah.
As a victim?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes. Paul Bonacci was very young. I mean, by the time this was all happening in 1990, he was maybe 23.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Bonacci said that Emilio was the driver of the blue car who stopped to ask Johnny for directions. Bonacci said that he was actually in the car as well, hiding in the back. His job was to hold Johnny down after he was put in the car. Benassi later said that he was actually the first person who sexually assaulted Johnny and that he was ordered to do it while photos were taken for potential buyers.
Okay.
Noreen didn't find out about Paul Benassi until March of 1991. Because again, John didn't tell her. He went to visit him. He had Roy Stevens go do all these interviews, et cetera, et cetera. And then it sounds like Roy Stevens and not John was actually the person who eventually did tell Noreen about this. So in March of 1991, she went to visit him herself. Now, when she went, she basically wanted to perform her own tests to not only see if he was telling the truth, but also if her personal theories were true.
So I still have some questions about the confession, though.
Yes. No, I'm going to get into to more details
all right,
still.
All right.
Because a lot more comes out, you know, it all comes out in stages and more comes out after he meets with Noreen. One thing that she did right off the bat was she gave Roy Stevens a photo for Benassi. She didn't tell Stevens anything about this photo. She just wanted to see if Benassi knew the person in the photograph. So Stevens took the photo, put it in a lineup with about a dozen other photos. He then showed all of them to Paul and said, "Hey, do you recognize any of these men?" When Paul Benassi looked through the photos, he picked out the one that Noreen sent. He said that he did know him. He said that he was the local contact who came to the motel the night before Johnny's abduction with a photo of Johnny informing the kidnappers that he was the kid they were going to take. He said that the man's name was Sam. For quite a while after this, it was only the first name that was ever reported on, but Noreen later revealed that the photo she gave Roy Stevens to give to Paul Bonacci was of Sam Soda. And if you'll recall, Sam Soda was the private investigator from the last episode who apparently had an informant who knew about Eugene Martin's upcoming abduction and brought down a pedophile who worked with paper boys.
Come on. This is like some fucked up movie shit.
Yeah, no, it's insane. That's what I'm saying. That is why so many documentaries and everything have been made about this case, because it's completely bonkers.
Okay, so Sam was the one that coordinated all of this?
I don't think he was the mastermind, but his role was like he was the local contact. So he was the person who lived in Des Moines, because this pedophile ring is out of Omaha, according to Paul Benassi.
Okay.
So the pedophile ring is based in Omaha. Paul is from Omaha, but Sam Soto was their guy in Des Moines who would apparently pick out the victims. Now, this episode is going to be tough because we're talking about child sex abuse here.
Right.
But, you know, in subsequent interviews that Paul would give, he would talk about how they would go after different types of children because they had different buyers who are looking for different things. And they had kids who are basically considered to be like the throwaway kids. So the runaways, the people who were already gone, who didn't have anybody looking for them, who had been on the streets, who had maybe turned to sex work already to survive.
Yeah.
They would bring them in. But then there is also a separate market for
the cleaner cut.
Yeah.
The more innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The new kids, basically.
Yeah.
And so Sam's job was apparently to find these kids. And so he somehow, some way, identified Johnny as a victim prior to his kidnapping. So again, I mentioned that, you know, this whole story kind of came out in stages and it wasn't public for quite a while. So in 1991, it became publicly known that Benassi had confessed to being part of Johnny Gosch's abduction. And more evidence was found that seemingly substantiated his claims, including diaries that he had written that he didn't have access to at that time, because he had been in prison for these child molestation charges since 1989. And he didn't meet with the Goshist, with John Gosch, until 1990. So these diaries were definitely created before he ever met with either one of the Goshes.
Yeah, that's kind of where my line of questioning was how can they validate this? Because
anyone can say that they were in the back of a car and
Right. And everything that all the information that he gave was public knowledge at this point, up until, you know, what could have been a made up story, what happened afterwards.
Right.
So okay. So what was in it? What was in the diaries?
Okay. Between what Paul had allegedly told Noreen and like what was in these diaries, this is some of the information that, at least to Noreen, proved that he was for real. He described marks on Johnny's body, including a birthmark on his chest, and scars on his body, including a horseshoe-shaped scar in his tongue from when he had like bitten through his tongue like as a small child. He brought up, unprompted, the fact that Johnny stuttered when he was nervous or scared. He brought up that Johnny had gone with Noreen to, he said, either like a meditation or yoga classes, something like that. And that was true. And that was not something that Noreen had ever talked about.
This is in the diaries or
this? No, this is stuff that he told Noreen.
Okay.
He also talked about a second vehicle nearby, which was a white van. Now, this white van is something that private investigators had uncovered very early on in the investigation, that there's this second kind of suspicious vehicle in the area at the time, but that had not been made public. Paul said that this white van was a part of the plot and that they actually transferred Johnny to the van from the car.
Because nothing's more conspicuous than a white van.
In 1982, everyone had one. Oh, and by the way, Sam Soto had a white van. But, you know, so did a lot of other people. He even detailed a time when Johnny and some other kids used red nail polish to write in the stalls of a bathroom in a Denver restaurant. Johnny wrote, "Johnny Gosch was here." Now, what's interesting is that the Goshes already knew about this restaurant because it had been spotted, the nail polish writing had been spotted at the time by family friends who had told them about that. And then Paul talked about it. He was like, yeah. And then this one time we were like in this restaurant and he was shown a picture of the outside of the restaurant in Denver. And they were like, is this the restaurant? I said, oh, yeah, it was this one. And then he went on to describe the interior of the restaurant, which was apparently like a pretty unique interior. And he said, yeah, we wrote with red nail polish on the bathroom.
Okay. So there's obviously a lot of evidence validating what he's saying.
Yeah. Well, and before you get into anything else, I do also want to mention, so in addition to what he told Noreen during these interviews and what he told Roy Stevens earlier and the diaries that were found, he also had a stash of letters that had been sent to him by people that he claimed were other kids who had been brought into this. And the letters mentioned JG, Emilio, who, again, Emilio is the man that Paul says was driving the car, and other people, like there's this guy named the captain, other people that Paul had said were involved in this. And so he had all of these letters that mentioned all of the same people, including Johnny, that, you know, kind of backed him up, basically.
So I guess my next question would be, why is he confessing to all of this?
So at this point, he is trying to bring down the people who are in charge of this pedophile ring.
So he's not asking for a lighter sentence on time he's already serving?
No, I think he is, because he was in jail for child molestation charges. And I do think that he was trying to use. Yeah, I think he was trying to use that in some way. But there's a lot more about the court cases surrounding this that I'll get into. Okay. That will explain that a little bit further. So again, all of this is starting to get media attention, right? In 1992, Paul Bonacci's claims were enough to catch the eye of my favorite show, America's Most Wanted. A producer is interviewed extensively in the Who Took Johnny documentary, and he details their interviews with Bonacci and their efforts to corroborate his claims and also figure out what happened to Johnny. The AMW team found Bonacci to be credible, and a lot of things started stacking up. At one point, Paul said that Johnny was branded, and he described the brand, what it looked like. During this whole investigative period, another man came forward and agreed to be interviewed anonymously by the show. And he corroborated Paul's statements and said that he had been friends with Johnny during this whole thing. He even had the same brand that Paul had described and said that this brand was given to the victims of this pedophile ring as punishment. They even traveled with Paul out to Colorado to an abandoned home where he says they were kept for a time. So they all, as you can imagine, moved around, right? Right. And so in addition, again, his whole confession and his whole story of what happened to Johnny and this pedophile ring in general is way, 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 way more detailed than what I'm going to be getting into in this episode. I mean, but he does detail like, okay, so we got Johnny and then we went to this one place and we were kept in this windowless room and then they moved us to this other place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He really kind of broke down all of the movements. But then at some point they were taken to this house in Colorado. So when America's Most Wanted gets there, the house has been abandoned, mm-hmm. and the owner of record was apparently a prison guard who had disappeared.
Come on.
I don't know. But that's what the producer says in the documentary. Like, yeah.
This story is out of control.
It is. So there's footage of them taking Paul to this house in Colorado. He goes up to like the threshold of the house and just starts sobbing uncontrollably. He eventually kind of calms down and says, okay, I can go in. And, you know, he had described like the whole house and everything to them beforehand. And when they got there, just as he had described, there was a crawl space underneath the house. And underneath it were like support beams mm-hmm. and things like that, that he claims they were tied to. But on the support beams, you can see initials are carved in everywhere.
Jesus.
Yeah. So it's crazy, though, because, like, you know, the producer from America's Most Wanted is talking in this documentary. He's like, you know, he's telling this story. Everything's seeming to check out, but, like, we couldn't quite get all of the pieces to fall into place. You know what I mean? Like, the house was owned by this guy, but he disappeared. Like, they couldn't get to Johnny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they had these people who said, oh, yeah, I knew him before, but we're out of it. Like, it just, the guy, he was frustrated. He's like, we tried really hard to solve this. And he's like, we got close, I feel like. He said, but we couldn't quite get there. And he said, ultimately, like, I do think that this guy's mostly telling the truth, at least. He's like, but I don't know.
This is nuts.
Yeah. So at this point, we should check in with the West Des Moines police. Despite Paul Benassi's statements and the evidence that seems to corroborate it, I'm not saying 100%,
no.
That, like, you know, and all of the work that America's Most Wanted put into this case and all of the media attention that this is getting, because obviously, like, a guy confesses, it's a pedophile, like, this is big news, right?
Yeah.
They never even bothered to interview Paul Benassi. Not even once.
That's because Johnny's still a runaway.
Right. They didn't believe him to be credible. What I will say, and this is very 80s and 90s, I guess, because I think this happened in the late 80s. Paul Benassi had been diagnosed with multiple personality disorder.
Okay.
Yeah. And he claimed to have like 112 different personalities or something like that, right? So they said because of that, he's just not reliable. Like, he's a nutcase. And okay,
I mean, you can't just say that on a whim without doing an interview. You can't just be like, ah, well.
The West Des Moines police would beg to differ. So they never once spoke to him.
I think at this point we should talk about maybe a little bit about the misdiagnosis of multiple personality disorders.
Oh, yeah. Like it's not
it's
real.
It's not a real thing.
Yeah.
That is a real thing, but it is extremely, extremely rare for it to actually be dissociative disorder.
Right.
And this whole coining of a phrase of multiple personality disorder was a terrible misdiagnosis. And it was mostly not brought on by the psychological field.
Yeah.
It was mostly brought on because it was a catchy phrase and it was something fascinating.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, listen, Paul Benassi was clearly traumatized.
Yes.
Terrible things of some sort happened to him. He clearly went on to victimize other people.
Yes.
However, I don't think that necessarily means that you can discount everything that he says right off the bat, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. And so that's the biggest thing. And that seems to be kind of the stance as this case kind of goes on and as Paul Benassi's different cases go on, because he's got a lot of different things happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people are like, okay, I don't know if 100% of what you're saying is real, but I think something happens.
Yeah.
And like, it's reasonable to assume that the substance of what you're saying is true.
Right.
Basically. So yeah, we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but yeah, it's just, I don't know. That's just something to think about. The other thing that I think the police and others have used to discredit him is that Paul Benassi's siblings apparently said that he couldn't have been involved in Johnny's kidnapping because he was in Omaha, where he's from, that day. But they weren't interviewed until, you know, 10 years later. So, like, how would they really know for sure if he was in Omaha that day? Also, Paul Benassi was being sexually abused by multiple people. So, like, I don't know
what... In Omaha.
Yeah, so I don't know, like, what his relationship with his siblings could have been at that point for them to be able to definitively say where he was at all, you know?
Right.
So, like, that struck me as weird. The other thing that people who don't believe Paul Benassi say is that they believe that when he was, like, meeting with Noreen, for instance, and John Gosch, and even probably to some extent the private investigator, they say that he is basically a cold reader, that he was using the techniques that a lot of, like, TV psychics use and basically doing cold readings to make it seem like he had this knowledge that was not available, but that, in fact, the people he was talking to, especially Noreen, had unwittingly given him that information.
To what end, though?
Attention, basically. I mean, mainly attention, that, like, and for it to bolster him in his other cases, basically. From, you know, from Noreen's standpoint... Again, it goes back to what I was kind of saying at the end of the last episode. Some people think that maybe she didn't necessarily believe Paul's story, but recognized that it could continue to propel her son's case forward. And well, she had been already
on, like, counter conspiracy theories.
Well, no, I know. That's what I'm saying. This thing's a rat's nest. But, like, but she, especially because she had already been talking about a pedophile ring for years at that point, right? So she gets somebody who's saying, oh, yes, you're right. This is what happened. Whether she believed him or not, you know, it could be said that, like, okay, it's proving her point and it's getting attention and, you know, it's getting her the result that she wants, basically.
I guess.
That's why, like, there's just nothing definitive about any part of this story. It's just so hard to really grasp onto something.
Yeah, but, okay, so the cold reading thing, didn't you say there were diaries?
Yeah.
That he hadn't had access to?
Right.
So what was in the diaries that
it was just basically more stuff about the pedophile ring that did, again, mention JG, Emilio, and then the other people. It just basically seemed to kind of back up the stories he was telling to the gossips.
I mean, you can't, that's not a cold read.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe he was cold reading and embellished a little bit, but, like, if he doesn't have access to these journals or diaries or whatever, and you go back and read through some of them and there's some evidence there to back up some of the claims of what he was saying, that's not something that can be faked.
Yeah. Oh, and I should mention too that the guy who was interviewed anonymously by America's Most Wanted also produced a diary of his own that had similar claims.
There's too much there. And again, I don't believe in coincidences. there's too much there.
Yeah.
There's something there.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying it's 100% of what Benassi is saying, but there's something there.
You would think, but again, West Des Moines police did not agree. They did not think that something was there. A letter to the editor that the Goshes wrote in 1991 detailed their frustration with police and the FBI. It reads in part, quote, John DeCamp, Paul Benassi's attorney, shared in a written statement all of Paul's remarks with the FBI office in Omaha. All of this time, we hoped and prayed they would make contact with Paul and check for themselves the accuracy of the statements about the kidnapping. Silence from the FBI followed. Nothing happened. So we pursued the information just as parents have always done. Then all hell broke loose when this story hit the news media. The story was not released by us or our private investigator. However, we had to deal with the effects of this untimely release. Again, we tried to look on the positive side and hope with this all being out in the open, including the names of the kidnappers, that surely the authorities would then seek out Paul Benassi and talk to him again. Again, silence followed by their declaration from their offices that they had decided Paul is not credible on our case, that due to a multiple personality disorder, he has fabricated all of the information about Johnny. They went on to say, quote, if that is true, how was Paul able to select the correct photograph from a lineup of photos and tell us about the local man in Des Moines named Sam and his involvement in our case? Paul has correctly given us his first and last name. This man has been a suspect in the case for 4 years. This is quite a coincidence. If this terrible tragedy could happen to our son and the years of pain and work to solve it could be thrown away when a confession finally comes in the case by the authorities, it could happen to anyone. Those responsible for our son's kidnapping are still free. We know who they are at this time, but nothing would prevent them from kidnapping again, especially when they see and hear news reports that authorities will do nothing to help. End quote.
Do you think maybe they're so quick to dismiss it? Do you think maybe they're connected somehow? And maybe that police officer at the football game had something to do with it?
Yeah, I don't know about the police officer.
Am I going off on my own conspiracy theory?
I mean,
now?
Yeah, but so is everybody else. So I don't know about the police officer in the football game, because like I said, that thing kind of died out very quickly. But the chief of police has been suspected of possibly being involved, not necessarily in Johnny's abduction, but in these like sex parties and things like that. He actually was later kind of forced to resign because of drinking on the job, which, I mean, to be fair, I feel like all cops did in the 80s, but drinking on the job and just different ethical complaints. So yeah, like he definitely did have his own ethical issues. I think I read too that he was caught shoplifting at one point. Yeah, just like a weird guy all around. So he definitely did have some shadiness around him. I don't know to what extent, though. I don't know to what extent he was like legitimately trying to cover something up and to what extent he was just incompetent. Hmm. Now, this is when we have to get a little bit deeper into the conspiracy, though. Paul Benassi claims that the pedophile ring was part of the Franklin Federal Credit Union scandal. Now, this is a whole other rabbit hole onto itself and could be the subject of like a 10-part deep dive. Like, it's just nuts. The short version of the story is that a man named Larry King, not that Larry King.
Okay.
Was the director of the credit union. He was also a rising star in the Republican Party. He actually like was at the last two Republican conventions. I believe he sang the national anthem. I think that's why he was there. I don't recall exactly why he was there, but he was at the last two Republican conventions. And like I said, rising star. He eventually went down, as did the entire credit union, because he embezzled about $40 million.
Wow.
But many people alleged that his crimes were not only financial. A handful of young people accused King of auctioning them off for sex and holding parties that were attended by politicians and other prominent people in which underage girls and boys were provided for sex. Mm. The victims alleged that they were flown to multiple locations. They were plied with drugs and alcohol to make them more compliant. And that attendees were in the upper echelon of government, including the FBI. Despite many different witnesses, including social workers who were like, hey, I think there's a sex abuse problem in Omaha, because allegedly a lot of King's victims came from Boys Town, which was an organization for troubled youths. So social workers were involved. And right. So that's yeah. How the social workers like, I think something's happening here. So, I mean, it wasn't just kids who were coming out and saying this, like it was people who were responsible for keeping an eye out for stuff like this. But despite all of that, nothing came of the accusations, and King was only ever like convicted of the financial crimes. Paul Benassi was one of the people who testified against King. And so this whole thing, this Franklin Federal Credit Union scandal and his whole confession, like they were kind of happening all together to some extent. And not only was King not convicted of like any sex crimes or anything like that, but Paul and another woman were actually convicted of perjury. Prosecutors said that they lied on the stand about all of this. And again, convicted them of perjury. The woman actually went to jail. Paul didn't end up serving extra time for this because he was already in prison.
Yeah.
So I guess they just let it go or whatever. But yeah, so they like came down on them very hard. And so that only further destroyed...
Based on what, though?
Listen, it's a whole other thing. But like, but that only further destroyed Paul's credibility to a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Because you're like, he was convicted of perjury. He's just some crazy guy who's making all of this up, right? None of this happened. There is no pedophile ring. Larry King is a guy who embezzled money. That's it. Johnny Gosch is a poor kid who got kidnapped. That's it.
Hmm.
Paul, of course, maintains that he was telling the truth. And actually, he ended up suing Larry King civilly in the late 90s. And that's actually where a whole lot of the information from Noreen comes in, because she gave sworn testimony in this civil suit about, you know, everything that Paul had told her and the evidence and da-da-da-da-da. She testified about what Paula told her about the sex ring and the abduction of her son. And then that's where yet another insane twist happens.
Okay.
So this trial is taking place in 1999.
The civil trial.
The civil trial, yeah. Okay. While she's on the stand, and I don't know, I'm like so curious as to why the lawyer thought to ask this. But while she is on the stand, the lawyer asks Noreen if she has had any contact with her son after September 5th, 1982. She says yes.
What?
In 1999, Noreen testifies that in 1997, Johnny came to visit her at her West Des Moines apartment.
What?
She was living there as she and John Gosch had divorced in the mid-90s. She claimed that Johnny was with another man and that when he came to her door, she immediately recognized him. But he even opened his shirt up to show her the birthmark on his chest, and they came in to talk. She said that they spoke for about an hour or an hour and a half, and he told her that he was still in danger. He also said that he couldn't tell her where he was going or where he was living, and he asked her not to tell anyone that she saw him. So she didn't, until she was put under oath in court. She had never even told John Gosch about the visit. So after all of this, yeah, if you were curious to know more about this and other things, after all this became public, Noreen wrote a book called Why Johnny Can't Come Home.
I'm still, my head just exploded. So I'm still trying to get everything. So, okay, yeah. In 97, he shows up at her apartment out of the blue, which I don't know how he would have known where she lived.
And that is a question that also occurred to a lot of other people.
97, so he would have been 28, thereabouts?
Yeah, thereabouts.
So he's an adult at this point, but he's still in danger.
Mm-hmm. And so this other man he was with, Noreen said that he didn't really talk and that Johnny seemed nervous around him and would kind of look at him before he spoke to kind of like get permission almost.
Uh-huh. Did he say where he was living?
No, he said that he couldn't tell her and that he was still wrapped up in this like criminal element So like he was in danger. He was like, he couldn't tell her any details.
What did they talk about for that hour then?
Yeah, I'm sure it's in the book. It's not in the articles that I read. I have not been able to get my hands on the book yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I told you this case is insane. That's why it's our season finale.
I'm sure that the people that have been trying to discredit her from the get-go are jumping on this.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, this all seems completely fucking nuts.
Yeah.
And, again, how did he know where to find her if this is an apartment that she's renting and not their home?
Right. Because, yeah, the home's gone. They sold the house several years prior to this visit. Yeah,
like, how would he have found
that out? Divorced somewhere between 93 and 95. And yeah. I assume that's when the home was sold.
Sure. But like, how would he know where to find her? And then him spouting conspiracy theories at the age of 28 about how he's still not safe or whatever. It's just, I'm sure they were latching onto that and saying, see, she's nuts.
For sure. If we're talking about people who questioned this, one of them would be Johnny's father, John. Mm-hmm. He doubts Noreen's claim of a visit. He told Frank Santiago of the Des Moines Register, quote, apparently she's trying to get more publicity or whatever to get on a talk show so she can go where it's warm, end quote.
What?
In the early days, they had both been on like every single talk show ever. By this point, John had really kind of stepped away, but she was still, again, trying to get as much publicity as possible. And, you know, a lot of those talk shows are filmed in L.A.
Ah, yes.
So I think that's basically what he meant.
Okay.
Noreen shot back that she didn't care about her ex-husband's opinion and said that when she told everybody this, she was under oath. And that's why she told everybody this. And she would never lie under oath. But John did, in that article, question Johnny being able to find Noreen's new apartment, as you mentioned, because that's not where they lived in 1982. So how would he know that?
Right. And it's not like apartment residences are matter of public record. It's, you know what I mean?
Well, I don't
know.
I mean, she could have been in the phone book.
Sure.
You know, it could have been that easy. It really could have. Like, I don't know. Yes, does it sound insane? Like, absolutely. But everything sounds insane. Like, every single part of it does. So who knows? But yeah, that wasn't even the end of it. This testimony comes out in 1999. Obviously, it makes the news. It's a big deal. But that dies down and things go quiet for a while. But in 2006, someone left an envelope on Noreen's doorstep. Inside were several photos of young boys who were bound and gagged. She swore that one of the boys in those photos was Johnny. However, after an investigation, a Florida detective came forward, and he was actually interviewed on camera in the documentary. He came forward and identified one of the photos as having come from a case he worked back in 1979. He had suspected it was some sort of like pedophile thing, but when they identified the boys, they wouldn't talk. So it could have been something, it could have been nothing. Either way, according to this detective, it happened in 1979, so it had nothing to do with Johnny.
Yeah.
However, there was a black and white photo along with this. So the photo that he's specifically referring to is of three boys lying on a bed with gags in their mouth and their feet and their hands tied behind their back. And that photo, he says, yes, this photo specifically, I can name all three of these boys. Like, we investigated this, whatever, whatever. There's another photo in the package that Noreen received that is of one boy, and it's black and white, and she says that that's Johnny. The boy doesn't have a shirt on in the photo, and she says that you can see his birthmark. Now, they also show this picture in the documentary. Other people are like, maybe, but it could just be a shadow. Like, it's just really hard to tell.
Yeah.
It's just not clear either way.
Okay.
The same detective said, yeah, no, that photo is also from a separate case that I investigated. But when he was asked, like, he couldn't say, oh, yeah, it's Timmy Nelson, or, you know, he couldn't name the person and he couldn't say with 100% certainty that that photo was linked to a separate case. He just thought that it was. So that one's a little muddier. It's pretty definitive that the photo of the three boys has nothing to do with Johnny. The black and white photo is a little bit murky.
Okay. All that aside, who would send her these pictures?
Why? Good question. Why What's the point pictures? Of that, right? Yeah, right? Yeah. No idea. So is this Johnny, or did somebody get a hold of these photos? And again, is this just another hoax?
Yeah.
Is it just somebody tormenting this woman with photos of boys who, you know, could be her son, but they know aren't? As I mentioned, John Gosch has kind of receded from the spotlight. He did come back to be interviewed for that documentary, Who Took Johnny? And he does still go along with the pedophile theory, basically. Like, he doesn't come out in the documentary and say, like, oh, no, absolutely not. Some, like, a single person kidnapped him and then murdered him, whatever. Like, he does still kind of believe that. But in recent years, you know, and you can really get the feeling based on that quote that he gave in the article about her wanting to be on a talk show or whatever. Like, he has seemingly kind of come around to the side of the people who think that Noreen's kind of a whack job. He also says that he's not sure if Johnny is alive or not. Also, over the years, despite being very adamant in the beginning that Paul Benassi's story, you know, was truthful, he has come out against Benassi in recent years. And he has said that he doesn't think that he was telling the truth. In the early to mid 90s, once John and Noreen split, their paths seemingly diverged to a point. But one thing that is not in question is the impact that Johnny Gosch's case and Noreen's advocacy has had on missing children's investigations. I mentioned the Johnny Gosch Foundation and the Johnny Gosch Bill in the first episode, but I mean, that was only the beginning. While many people know missing New York child Ethan Patz as the first missing child to be shown on a milk carton, he actually wasn't. He was just the first one to be shown nationally. In 1984, Anderson and Erickson Dairy, which was based in Iowa, printed the very first milk cartons with missing children on them, and they featured Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin. But more importantly, the Gosch's lobbying efforts, along with those of parents of other missing children, directly led to the founding of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in 1984. This case is one of the stories that really changed American society and the way that children are treated, for better or for worse. And that's what we talked about at the beginning when you mentioned the stranger danger, because, you know, it definitely changed things in Des Moines and Iowa, like, very early on, right? Like, you got to think, I mean, with these kidnappings, multiple kidnappings of paper boys, with the sex abuse of other paper boys, that kind of started going away in Des Moines pretty quickly thereafter. You know, this whole idea of preteen and, you know, early teenage children getting up and delivering newspapers by themselves early in the morning just did not last. And I don't know about you, I don't know about where you grew up, but anytime I would see papers getting delivered, it was always like somebody in a minivan. Like, it was never, I've never seen a paper boy in my entire life.
Well, so my childhood, I definitely saw paper boys, but my friend George, his whole family would go out. This is when we were in high school, and they had been doing it for years. So his whole family would go out and get papers, but each one of them had a route. So the mom would drive the minivan full of the kids, full of newspapers, and like drop them off basically on various routes so that they could, you know, deliver their papers, and then they'd get picked up again and move on. So that in that did still occur. There were definitely times. I mean, I went with George at like 4 a.m. when we were delivering newspapers. And there were definitely stretches where if I hadn't been with him, it would be him by himself.
Yeah.
Or his sisters.
Right.
by themselves delivering newspapers. So it was still kind of a thing. And this is, you know, late 90s.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, I wonder if that's still going on now.
I doubt it.
I mean,
you know, hey, look, I get up at that time of day, and what I see now is the person in the car not getting out of the car.
Yeah.
Like pulling up to a house, throwing it, and then driving off. I don't see kids doing that anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. But it's just one of those things where, like, you know, it used to be go out and play until the streetlights come on type of thing. And this is one of those cases that led to that kind of going away in America.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
For sure.
And yeah, I mean, it had a very lasting impact just on the way parents behave, in addition to the societal impact of like creating NCMEC. I mean,
yeah,
that's gigantic, right? This case is really a turning point in our country. It's huge.
Yeah. And you think about the multi-generational effects that it had. I mean,
yeah,
obviously nationwide, like we grew up in the stranger danger era because mm-hmm. of cases like this. And now we're parents, and some people, not that I think you and I are particularly helicopter parents, but we're way more aware of where our kids are than our parents
for
were.
For sure.
You know, I mean, like when I was with, you know, my first son's mom, I was so paranoid. If he was outside playing with the neighborhood kids, I'd be sitting out on the porch.
Yeah.
You know, or she would be.
Yeah.
Like there was never a point where he was not within eyesight. You know, of course, I was a latchkey kid growing up.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I had a key to the house.
Yeah.
If I was sick and stayed home from school, parents were gone.
Oh, for sure.
I had the house to myself. Yeah. You know?
Oh, yeah. You watched Price is Right and like you just lived your life.
Yeah, it was the best.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, listen, I was given, mine was pretty dicey because mine started at like 4 years old, but I was given instructions to not answer the door and not use the oven. Like that was it.
Right. Yeah. And now if, you know, if one of our kids is sick, we stay home.
Yeah.
It's a different world now.
It is.
You know?
Yeah. And this is one of the reasons. Noreen Ghosh believes that her son is still alive out there somewhere after being subjected to years of horrific acts. John Ghosh goes back and forth on what he believes, but police say that while the investigation is open, they do not believe that Johnny is alive. So is this a vast criminal conspiracy? Was there a pedophile ring operating in the Midwest in the early 80s? Or were the abductions of Johnny Ghosh, Eugene Martin, and others just crimes of opportunity perpetrated by sick individuals? Many people believe that they definitively know the answer to that question, but what that answer is can't be agreed on. John David Ghosh was 5'7" and 140 pounds. He had light brown hair, blue eyes, and freckles. He was last seen wearing a white sweatshirt with Kim's Academy printed on the back and either black sweatpants or cutoff jeans and blue flip-flops. Johnny Ghosh was 12 years old when he went missing. He would be 52 today. If you have any information on what happened to Johnny Ghosh, please contact the West Des Moines Police Department at 515-223-3211. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here soon for season 3.
See you next season.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.